On our advertising leaflet, that you were told I was going to talk about living for God in dysfunctional families. Now, the Sunday magazine didn't know that we were going to come here, but they very helpfully, just a few weeks ago, ran an article like this. Recognise any of them? Sex, lies, scandal, the world's most dysfunctional family. So thank you very much, the Telegraph, or the Sun Herald, was it? Sunday magazine. Esther sent me this, the article, and it's a very interesting one indeed. You know who the families are, don't you? Who are they? Who do you recognise? Do you reckon they're dysfunctional? That's right. And what about this family here? Do you know who they are? Pardon? No. The Morans. They're a Sydney family who in the last 12 months or so have been in the courts, and one of the members of the family committed suicide, and Mr. Moran sued the wife of his son, and it was a great scandal in Sydney. Who's this family down here? The Kennedys. I'm a Kennedy. No relation. Have you read any of the Kennedy stories? I've got a book called The Kennedy Women. It's about this thick. Oh, they're dysfunctional, aren't they? And who's it? Bill. Good old Bill. He put a new spin on what dysfunctional was all about, didn't he? So, you know, that's what we think of, though, don't we? Is that what you think of when you think of dysfunctional families? Actually, this article says, one of the things the article says is, quite when we all began talking about dysfunctional families is unclear. Dr. Linda Campbell, a lecturer in social work at the University of Melbourne, said it's bandied about by almost everyone when discussing, well, usually, everyone's family but our own. That's how it works, doesn't it? Well, I just wanted to bring it a little closer to home. Is that it? Who's that? That's me? And my husband? This is 34 years ago in early May, and this is us setting off to create our perfect family. Who's done this? Anyone else done this? I did it. Absolutely. Now what I want to show you. Now what do you think? Perfect. Now I must tell you that Betty Newington's daughter, Betty's here. She's the other grandmother in our family. Betty's daughter is my daughter-in-law. Okay? But she's not in this photo, so Betty, I'm not talking about your family. This is my family. 34 years on, or 30 years on. I didn't start out to create or to be part of a dysfunctional family. But let me tell you some of the things that this family has coped with, and I'm not identifying any of the people. But let me tell you, this family has coped with bigamy, illegitimacy, adoption, physical disability, postnatal depression, marriage breakdowns. There are children here who were called upon to care for their sick parents when they were still being educated. That's tough. They have coped with teenage rebellion and its long-term consequences. Do you want me to go on? This is my perfect family. So I'm saying this is my dysfunctional family. And if I'm game enough to to identify myself as being part of a dysfunctional family. I'm just wondering if you're game enough to join me. So that means that today we're talking to all of us. This is not about our neighbour. This is not about other families that don't have the same problems that we have. You know, we all like to present ourselves in the very best way, and that's what we ought to do. I mean, it would be wrong for me to identify the people who have coped with those particular, most of those things. Some of them are okay. I'm the one who was born with a physical disability that's been corrected. Someone else too was born with a physical disability. So some things we say are okay to share, others we like not to say very much about. Then I come to my Bible and I discover it's full of dysfunctional people. What about Adam and Eve? What about Cain and Abel? A murder? So what we're going to look at this morning is how are we going to live for God in our dysfunctional families? What does it mean to live for God in a dysfunctional family? And then after lunch we're going to look at another dysfunctional family, but we're going to look at two issues: the issue of injustice and forgiveness. Big issues. Injustice is a huge subject, so we're looking at injustice in one family and how it runs, and then how forgiveness happens. So first off, we're going to look at the story of Abigail, and I've asked three of these lovely women from down here to read to us 1 Samuel chapter 25. It's the story of Abigail. Thanks, ladies.
Well, I'm the first reader, so this is, as Janice has said, from 1 Samuel chapter 25. Now, there was a man in Mammon whose business was in Carmel, and the man was very rich. He had 3,000 sheep and 1,000 goats, and he was shearing his sheep in Carmel. His name was Nabal, and his wife's name was Abigail. She was a woman of good understanding and beautiful appearance, but her husband was harsh and evil in his doings. He was of the house of Caleb. While David was in the desert, he heard that Nabal was shearing sheep, so he sent 10 young men and said to them, "Go up to Nabal at Carmel and greet him in my name. Say to him,
'Long life to you, good health to you and your household, and good health to all that is yours. Now I hear that it is sheep shearing time. When your shepherds were with us, we did not mistreat them, and the whole time they were at Carmel, nothing of theirs was missing. Ask your own servants, and they will tell you. Therefore, be favourable toward my young men, since we come at a festive time. Please give to your servants and your son David whatever you can find for them.'"
When David's men arrived, they gave Nabal this message in David's name. Then they waited. Nabal answered David's servants,
"Who is this David? Who is this son of Jesse? Many servants are breaking away from their masters these days. Why should I take my bread and water and the meat I have slaughtered for my shearers and give it to men coming from who knows where?"
David's men turned around and went back. When they arrived, they reported every word. David said to his men, "Put on your swords." So they put on their swords, and David put on his. About 400 men went up with David, while 200 stayed with the supply.
One of the servants told Nabal's wife Abigail, David sent messages from the desert to give our master his greetings, but he hurled insults at them. Yet these men were very good to us. They did not mistreat us, and the whole time we were out in the fields near them, nothing was missing. Night and day, they were a wall around us, all the time we were herding our sheep near them. Now think it over and see what you can do, because disaster is hanging over our master and his whole household. He is such a wicked man that no one can talk to him."
Abigail lost no time. She took 200 loaves of bread, 2 skins of wine, 5 dressed sheep, about 37 litres of roasted grain, 100 cakes of raisins and 200 cakes of pressed figs, and loaded them on donkeys. Then she told her servants, "Go on ahead, I'll follow you." But she did not tell her husband, Nabal. As she came riding her donkey into a mountain ravine, there were David and his men descending towards her, and she met them. David had just said, "It's been useless, all my watching over this fellow's property in the desert so that nothing of his was missing. He has paid me back evil for good." May God deal with David, be it ever so severely, if by morning I leave alive one male of all who belong to him."
When Abigail saw David, she quickly got off the donkey and bowed down before David with her face to the ground. She fell at his feet and said, "My lord, let the blame be on me alone. Please let your servant speak to you. Hear what your servant has to say. May my lord pay no attention to that wicked man Nabal. He is just like his name. His name is Fool, and folly goes with him. But as for me, your servant, I did not see the men my master sent. Now since the Lord has kept you, my master, from bloodshed and from avenging yourself with your own hands, as surely as the Lord lives and as you live, may your enemies and all who intend to harm my master be like Nabal, and let this gift which your servant has brought to my master be given to the men who follow you. Please forgive your servant's offence, for the Lord will certainly make a lasting dynasty for my master because he fights the Lord's battles. Let no wrongdoing be found in you as long as you live. Even though someone is pursuing you to take your life, the life of my master will be bound securely in the bundle of the living by the Lord your God. But the lives of your enemies he will hurl away as far from the pocket of a sling. When the Lord has done for my master every good thing he promised concerning him, and has appointed him leader over Israel, my master will not have on his conscience the staggering burden of needless bloodshed, or of having avenged himself. And when the Lord has brought my master success, remember your servant."
David said to Abigail, "Praise be to the Lord, the God of Israel, who has sent you today to meet me. May you be blessed for your good judgment and for your keeping me from bloodshed this day, from avenging myself with my own hands. Otherwise, as surely as the Lord, the God of Israel, lives, if you had not come quickly to meet me, not one male belonging to Nabal would have been left alive by daybreak." So David received from her hand what she had brought him, and he said to her, "Go in peace to your house. See, I have heard your words and granted your request."
When Abigail went to Nabal, he was in the house holding a banquet like that of a king. He was in high spirits and very drunk. So she told him nothing until daybreak, wise woman. Then in the morning, when Nabal was sober, his wife told him all these things, and his heart failed him, and he became like a stone. About 10 days later, the Lord struck Nabal, and he died.
When David heard that Nabal was dead, he said, "Praise be to the Lord, who has upheld my cause against Nabal for treating me with contempt. He has kept his servant from doing wrong and has brought Nabal's wrongdoing down on his own head."
Then David sent word to Abigail, asking her to become his wife. His servants went to Carmel and said to Abigail, "David has sent us to you to take you to become his wife." She bowed down with her face to the ground and said, "Here is your maidservant, ready to serve you and wash the feet of my master's servants." Abigail quickly got on a donkey and, attended by her 5 maids, went with David's messengers and became his wife. David had also married, don't know how to say that word, or that word, and they both were his wives. But Saul had given his daughter, Michal, David's wife, to Paltiel, son of Laish, who was from Galim.
Thank you. Hey, isn't it good to read someone else's story? And isn't it interesting when we get the whole story and we hear the nice ending? But we need to remember that Abigail didn't know the ending of her story. She had to live through it. And it's the same with us. We are right now living our own stories and we don't know how they're going to end. And also I'd like you to remember, when we look at Abigail's life, or even almost everybody's life in the Bible, we only get a little bit of it. This story about Abigail probably only covers about 2 or 3 weeks of her life. Now that's not long, is it? But there are lots of clues in there as to what kind of a woman Abigail was, and that's what I'm drawing on as I want to talk to you about this godly woman and how she lived and what lessons we can take and what practical help we find here for ourselves. So I'm not saying that Abigail always behaved perfectly, and we get her behaving so wisely, don't we? I think I get, I don't know about you, but as I hear and have read the story, I get the impression that this woman lived with dignity. There's a sense of dignity about all that she did. The second thing I notice is she was a woman with a great deal of common sense. And the third thing I notice, her faith in God and her understanding of who he was guided her behaviour. So if you remember nothing more, those are the three things that I think stand out. She lived with dignity, she was a woman who exercised common sense, and her faith in God and her understanding of who he was guided her behaviour. Now, to all outward appearances, life was good for Abigail. When you read the first few verses, what does it say? She was intelligent and beautiful. And I thought, and did you notice she had five personal maids? I thought, I could be beautiful if I had five personal maids, couldn't you? So the impression is that life was pretty good. Have you ever jumped to the wrong conclusion by outward appearances? Have you ever decided what another woman's life is like by how she looks? Join the club. I have a friend who was brought up in very humble circumstances, and I went to visit her a few years back, and I was amazed. She lived in a two-story beautiful house, and you know, the street was paved. Not the footpath, the street was paved. And the home was just beautiful. And I thought, oh, there's no doubt about this friend of mine. She's moved up in the world and it's going good for her. You know what I discovered? She would have rather lived in a tent for a happy and good relationship with her husband, because it was his house and she had to keep it clean. And she had to spend so much time that when she would have rather done other things, maintaining the house. On the other side, I've made wrong assumptions about people by looks. Just recently, I've been involved in some prison ministry, and we had a big team and 8 weeks training. The first night of training, I walked into this room and one woman stood out. She was black Maori, very, very dark. She had tattoos up her arm, both her arms. And I thought, tough woman this. This is the sort of woman you want in prison ministry, isn't it? She's obviously been somewhere that I haven't been. And I was a bit intimidated by the appearance of this woman. I thought, I wouldn't like to meet her in a dark alley. You know, by the end of the first night, I was captivated by this woman. Beautiful woman. Beautiful singing voice. She sang a song that she had written about her life and her experience in knowing God. And I had to take a step back. And a beautiful lady. But you see, I had jumped to the wrong conclusion. And she was loved by the women in Malawa. So back to Abigail. It appeared she had everything, but the truth was that her life was very difficult, wasn't it? Her husband was the kind of man that we wouldn't wish on our worst enemy. He was surly and mean. He was rude and aggressive. No one could talk to him. He liked partying and was a heavy drinker. And it would also seem he wasn't inclined to listen to his wife or take her advice. Would you wish that sort of man on anybody? But I think in Abigail's society, we could suppose that she didn't choose Abigail. We could suppose that she married the man of her parents' choice. We also could suppose that he may have been a lot older than her, as was often the case in this kind of society. So I set to wondering, was his wealth more important to her parents than his character? Is that why they chose him for their daughter? It's worth thinking about. So what can we learn from a woman in a very difficult marriage? And it's something that I have had to think about over the years. How God, am I to live in this circumstance that I find myself in? What does it mean to be godly where I live? We see Abigail in relationship with four different lots of people. We see her with the servant who came to her. We see her with David. And we see her with her husband. And we see her in relationship with God. So we see her in a lot of different relationships, and that's how we live, don't we? In a lot of different kinds of relationships. David is the best known in this story. We know who he was. And at this time he was living in the desert because he was being pursued by Saul, his father-in-law. And we learn quite a lot about David and his character from this story. He was a leader of men. Do you remember that he had 600 men with him? And these men were with him by choice. So he was the kind of man that people followed. They believed that he would be the next king of Israel. But I hear there's something else about David here. He's fair-minded. He believed that if he and his men provided a good service for Nabal, then it was fair enough that they go and ask for food for their work. So he was fair-minded. But he also had a touch of arrogance, didn't he? Because he didn't like being turned down, did he, by Nabal? And so he said, okay, get your swords on, rustle up the horses, we're going after this guy. And do you know how many men? 400 men? How big a household do you think Nabal had? It was more than a dozen, I think, if he was bringing 400 men to wipe out this man's household. How many men worked on this property? He had 1,000 goats, 3,000 sheep. So there perhaps were a lot of men. So he's going to take a vengeance out on Nabal and his family for refusing him. One servant of Nabal's says to himself, we've got trouble here. This is big trouble. What will I do about it? So he says, he goes and he talks to Abigail. What does that tell you about Abigail? It says heaps, doesn't it? He knew there was no point in going to Nabal and said, you've done the wrong thing. We need to help these guys. So he goes to Abigail. And I think it shows that she was a good listener. She listened to the story. Also, it tells me that she was in touch with reality. And if we're in difficult family circumstances, we need to be in touch with the reality. As the servant told the story, she knew what he said was true. He said, no one can talk to Nabal, he won't listen. She respected the servant. Now, he was a servant, but she respected what he said and believed his story. And I think it must have been very difficult. And I think it is always difficult if we live in a difficult situation and we have to work out where the line comes between loyalty and telling the truth. It's a very difficult thing. If you're going to say something about your husband, when are you being disloyal or when are you facing the reality? You know what she could have done? She could have said, don't believe you. My husband wouldn't have done something like that. And anyway, you're only a servant, so you know, nothing I can do about it. She might have said, let's pray about it. But that has solved it. There is that. You know, we don't know what to do, so let's pray about it. That'll solve it. You know, she's a woman of great common sense. And you know what I also see? In this difficult marriage, in this difficult circumstance, she had become her own person. She was dignified. She knew what to do. Could you rustle up enough food for 600 men at a moment's notice? How big's your pantry? I was very impressed. And I started to think, how many dress sheep would you send for 600 men? You know, five was right. Do you know, I went to, a party where they have a spit? They had a sheep, lamb, and they expected about 140 people. Only 70 turned up. That was an awful lot of meat over. And I thought, hey, five sheep was right. Five dress sheep would feed 600 men. Now, I don't know about all the other stuff, but how... So was this her task on the property? Was she in charge? It was a big job. And, you know, no deep freezers here. How did they store five dress sheep? They were all ready to load on. And also I noticed at the end of the story, Nabal had a banquet. Nobody noticed the food was missing. So how big a pantry was this? And how competent was this woman to be able to, okay, line up the donkeys. We'll have five of this, we'll have 37 of that, we'll have... Very capable woman. She had become her own person despite her circumstances. And you know, I thought, we don't have to be like the people we live with. We don't have to become like the people we live with. And we do not need to regard ourselves as victims of our circumstances. It appears to me that Abigail didn't regard herself as a victim. She took immediate action, and it was practical action. You know, it may be that in our families there is one person that is causing a lot of strife. It might be a child, it might be an adult child or a teenage child. Sometimes we need to draw lines, boundaries. Sometimes we need to say, that behaviour is not acceptable in this family. Sometimes we need to say to a husband, that behaviour is not acceptable. I do not have to be abused. Our children do not have to be abused. Do you think that's the opposite to what God says? Don't think so. If I read the New Testament aright, living with dignity does not mean becoming a doormat, accepting abuse for yourself or for your children. That's not part of what God asks us to do. So, the last sentence stands out really, but she did not tell her husband.
Ho ho.
Ever gone behind your husband's back? I remember, this is in a lighter vein, I remember once at church saying to an elderly lady, I had done something, I don't know what I had done, but something foolish, and I felt foolish about it. And I said, oh, Alec will get a good laugh out of this when he hears what I've done. And you know what she said to me? You know, you don't have to tell your husband everything. Ah, I didn't tell. Why is it necessary to run myself down if he wasn't there to observe it? And I have remembered that from time to time. Why didn't she go to him and debate with him that he'd made the wrong decision? Because she knew it would make no difference. And what was her priority? Her priority was to take care of the safety of the household. There is no mention that Abigail had children at all until later. So I don't know if she had children. I think it's unusual that it's not mentioned in the Old Testament because children were so important to the family. So she was, her concern, her priority was the safety of the employees and herself and her husband. So you know what she knew? She knew when to keep her mouth shut. Do you know? Do you know when to keep your mouth shut? Not easy. But sometimes wisdom and godly wisdom is not to say anything, just do what needs to be done in the circumstances. So then we move on to Abigail and David. So she sets up, she loads up the donkeys, says, "You go ahead." Now we're going to see not Abigail, the listener and the practical and the competent housewife. Now we see Abigail, the diplomat. Boy, she really shines here. She knows who David is. He's the future king. And what she is contemplating doing is very courageous. This man is very angry and he has 400 men with their swords on. Why would he listen to a woman? Just think of the culture. Why would he listen to Abigail? I mean, as a culture, it wasn't, you know, it's a dumb thing. How did the mother, you know what she did? She sent the food first. Bright lady. She said, "You go on ahead and I'll follow you." Wasn't that wise and witty? She knew what... See, David wanted the food. They were desperate. So let him see the food. Then he might listen to me. And the food would certainly put him in a better frame of mind, wouldn't it? The next thing I noticed, and did you notice, who had to read all that? Denise, did you have to read what she said? No, Kathy. Who read what she said? You did. Do you know something? You'll take the one. That's right. Who does she remind you of? She reminds me of someone I know here called Esther Allen. She was a good talker. My friend Esther down here is an excellent talker. And look, this is beautiful. It goes on and on. If you look, she goes on and on. Hang on, this woman's got a lot to say and nothing's going to stop her. She really had a lot to say. So, wasn't she confident in a difficult situation as well as courageous? She knew what she was about. She knew what she wanted to say and why she was doing what she was doing. No doubts about it. I don't know how long the donkey ride took, but she worked out what she was going to say, maybe on the way. And notice how she approaches David. She says, "Let the blame be all on me. I'll take the blame." Wonderful woman. You know, pay no attention to that wicked Nabal. But you know what else she says that I think sort of counters that? "But I did not see the men you sent." See what she's saying? If I'd heard the message, this wouldn't have happened. Isn't she? It's not all that, you know, meek and mild, is she? "I'll take the blame, Master David. But you didn't come and ask me." Otherwise, the outcome would have been different. So do you see, she's being very diplomatic, but she's also saying, "I'll take the blame, but I'm not to blame." Isn't she? She's taking the blame, but not the blame. But what I really notice, what's really important in this story, is what she says about God. These verses at the end here are what she believes about God, and this is what underlies all her life. This is what helps her live a godly life in her very difficult circumstances. Number one, she declares herself to be God's servant. That's a pretty big statement, isn't it? She says, she fell at his feet and said, "My Lord, let the blame be on me alone. Please let your servant speak to you. Hear what your servant has to say. May my Lord pay no attention to that wicked man Nabal. He's just like his name is Fool, and folly goes with him. But as for me, your servant, I did not see the men my master sent. So that was that bit. Now, since the Lord has kept you, my master, from bloodshed and from avenging yourself with your own hand, as surely as the Lord lives and as you live, may your enemies and all who intend to harm my master be like Nabal. And let this gift, which your servant has brought to my master, be given the men who follow you. She's saying, God sent me. God sent me. I wonder, do you think of yourself as God's servant in your difficult circumstances? Or do you feel very powerless, not able to make decisions for yourself and even decisions about your faith for yourself? Do you know, I lived through a period in my life where I had to work out what I was responsible for and what my husband was responsible for before God. You know how when you're married, you're sort of responsible for what the other person does, for what your partner does? And then something happens, you don't want to be responsible for that. And I had to work out, and okay, what am I responsible for here? I'm responsible for my relationship with God. I am not responsible for my husband's relationship with God. You know, that is a very freeing decision to make. And it opens up the way for you to grow independently as a believer, and your faith is your responsibility, not your husband's, not your children. And it seems to me Abigail is saying, I'm here because God has sent me, despite my circumstances. He's given me something to do. The second thing she says is, God doesn't support vengeance, David. That was pretty bold. David was an army man. He was a fighter. But there's a difference, she's saying, between fighting a real battle and taking vengeance. I want to read to you a few verses out of Romans 12. And it says, do not take vengeance, my friends, but leave room for God's wrath. For it is written, it is mine to avenge, I will repay, says the Lord. If your enemy is hungry, feed him. If he is thirsty, give him something to drink. In doing this, you will heap burning coals on his head. Do not overcome by evil, but overcome evil with good. Is that what Abigail did? It's exactly what she did. She said, you're fighting the wrong battle here, David. This is not a legitimate battle. This is personal vengeance, and it's wrong. Hang on, this is a brave woman telling David, the leader of 600 men, you're on the wrong track, mate. Goodness me. What does a woman have to believe to say that? She has to believe it. This was her belief, that God doesn't support vengeance. She said to David, David, you go and fight the Lord's battle. That's what you're to do. She says, please forgive your servant's offence. I mean, she's very diplomatic. I'm going to say something very harsh here to you, David, but please forgive me for being very straightforward. For the Lord will certainly make a lasting dynasty for my master because he fights the Lord's battle. Then she says, let no wrongdoing be found in you as long as you live. Okay? This is not one of those battles, David. You shouldn't be doing this. Strong words. And it comes to mind too, what battles do you fight in your family? How do you choose what battles to fight? Sometimes as women we're very good at making battles out of little things. Picking, nagging, forgetting sometimes we're not prepared to fight the big battle. So what do? We fight the little ones. And they often don't produce anything worthwhile. We fight the battle for our own dignity and pride, and we stand up for ourselves and defend ourselves madly. Our teenagers. Oh, you really have to choose with young people the battles you're going to fight. Are you going to fight the battle of a tidy room? You're going to lose it if you've got a son like mine, Betty. You see, sometimes the battle that we fight is not the important one. Oh, our son was dreadful. I remember one night Alec went into his room. I don't know what to open a window or close a window. And the floor was just littered. Martin was in bed and his sister. The dark spots are the floor, Dad. Tread on the dark. You know, there's a time to give up on some battles. There are more important battles to be fought within the family. There are battles concerned with real behaviour problems and real moral dilemmas. The other ones, yes, they're a pest and a nuisance and they frustrate us, but are we fighting the real battles? So, you know, are we wise in the battles that we take on within our family? The next thing she said, David, God is in charge of your life, not you. Now that was a... Where did she learn all this? This is an Old Testament lady. This is an Old Testament woman. Where did she get her understanding of God? I wonder, in her own family, as she was growing up? She could be. I think she might have. She said, even though someone is pursuing you to take your life, the life of my master will be bound securely in the bundle of the living by the Lord your God. I love that. It's a beautiful statement. Even though someone is pursuing you to take your life, the life of my master will be bound securely in the bundle of the living by the Lord your God. David, God is in charge of your life. God is sovereign. Ah, that's big stuff. Do you believe that God is in charge of your life? How do you say that when the wheels have fallen off? How do you say that when someone pulls the rug out from under you? God is in charge of my life. Well, God, and I've had this conversation with God a few times. Hang on, God, this doesn't look like you're in charge. This isn't in my dream plan. What's happening now is not what I anticipated as a godly woman. I didn't think you'd let these sort of things happen to me. Tough stuff. But she says, God is in charge of your life, and as long as God allows you to live, you will live. So then she says, but the lives of your enemies he will hurl away as from the pocket of a sling. What's she referring to? Who remembers David and his sling? Who remembers David and Goliath? I thought this was fabulous. How well informed she was. She knew a lot about David. She knew of his exploits. She was very politically aware. She knew what was happening in her world. She knew that Saul was the king. She knew Saul was pursuing David around the country. She knew David had done exploits for God back forever. And she reminds David here But the lives of your enemies he will hurl away as from the pocket of a sling. Remember David? Remember Goliath? God did that. You know, don't take over. God's in charge here. So you see, she had a firm understanding of who God was and of his place in her life. And it was not an easy life, but she knew who God was and what he did. The last one is beautiful. She said, God can be trusted to keep his promises. Do you believe that? Do you believe that when the wheels have fallen off? It's a bit hard when the wheels fall off to say God will keep his promises to me. What promises do we put after that? The promises we want to say is God has promised to iron out all the troubles and give me a nice retirement, plenty of money, grandchildren who are beautifully behaved all the time, adult children who give me no problems and no cause for concern. That's what I'd like God to promise me. It doesn't. But you know what she said? When the Lord has done for my master every good thing he promised concerning him and has appointed him leader over Israel. See what she's saying? God, you are going to be king, David, because God has said you're going to be king. Even though Saul is pursuing you to kill you, he cannot do it because God has promised that you will be king. And she says, because that's going to happen, there's something I don't want you to go to that very important role with. She says, my master will not have on his conscience the staggering burden of needless bloodshed or of having avenged himself. What's she saying? Be very careful, David, what you do before you come king. Because it'll live on. You'll have to live with it. And we're going to find out in the next session what it means to live with stuff that's happened for a long time, or stuff that we do wrong, and how it lives and has a life of its own. So she says, David, God can be trusted to keep his promises to you. Don't you do anything foolish. Don't avenge yourself. It's God's job. Oh boy, I wish I was Abigail. Wasn't she mature? Didn't she know who God was and how he operated in her life? And you know, that makes a woman who walks with dignity. That's what undergirded her life. That's why she walks with confidence and dignity, because she knows who God is and who he is for her. And all those things she was saying for David, she knew applied in her life. Now the last bit is Abigail and her husband. You know, I thought here, when she confronts Nabal, now I thought, here is a woman of integrity. You know, she didn't say anything to him, did she? When she went off with the, you know, with the servant, she said not a word. It seemed to me that this household was very large and the pantry was huge. Because when she came home, he was having a banquet as fit for a king. He didn't know that half the pantry had been emptied, did he? So he had no reason to confront her at all. He didn't know what she'd done. Did she need to tell him? It was a decision she had to make. And what was going to happen when she told him? What do you think? She knew that he would blow his stack. Why didn't she tell him when he was drunk and wouldn't remember? I think it was Denise. He said, wise woman. You see, she chose to confront this man with his deeds. So she didn't hide, she wasn't prepared to just forget it. This was too important. This man needed to understand what he had done and what had happened within this big community that she had to handle because of his bad behaviour. Now she chose her moment when to confront him. And if you have lived with an angry man, you'll know that's not easy to do. When do you confront a raging man or a drunk? When do you confront a surly and mean person? Most of us run for cover and never. And what happens? They get away with it. They do it time and time and time again. Confronting someone with bad behaviour takes courage. Don't ever say to a friend who's in a very difficult situation, well, just tell him. Come on. Can't be that hard. It can be almost impossible. It can be. Don't underestimate the difficulties that your friends have in facing an angry man. But she chose her moment. She wasn't going to let the information drift to him by the back door. She's up front. Integrity. Nabal, you behaved badly. This is what happened. This is what I had to do to preserve your wealth, your property, your people. And what was his response? Just what you would understand. He blew his back. Rage. This was not anger. Do you have a heart attack? You're just expressing anger? What brings on a heart attack? Rage. This man was in a rage. Courageous woman. And God dealt with Nabal. You see, the principle is the same as she said to David. Let God take care of it. She didn't know, and maybe she confronted him endless times. People like this do have to be confronted endless times. And it had made no difference. She wouldn't know what was going to happen when she confronted Nabal. And it seems he had a heart attack or a stroke. He burst a blood vessel in rage. 10 days later he died. Who decided? God. God. So Abigail did the right thing, didn't she? And she left it to God to handle Nabal. And he did. Of course it ended up nicely, didn't it, for Abigail? David heard, future king comes and sends, come and be my wife. He already had a wife, but that was the time, wasn't it? And she took five personal maids with her, but what did she leave? She left great wealth, and where did she go and live? In the caves. That's where David was living. And if you go over further in Samuel, you'll find that at one stage the Philistines came and carried her off. She had a child with David. Now maybe Nabal couldn't have children. Maybe that was why he was so angry. Children would have been very important. There is no mention of children, which is very unusual. But she took her five maids with her, and they went and lived with David in the hills, in the desert, until he became king over Israel. And don't you think she was glad to exchange the wealth for a husband who said, what did he say about her? Didn't he thank God for it? What did he say? When David heard that Nabal was dead, he said, praise be to the Lord. who has upheld my case against Nabal for treating me with contempt. He has kept his servant from doing wrong and has brought Nabal's wrongdoing down on his own head. And he had said to Abigail, "Praise be to the Lord, the God of Israel, who has sent you today to meet me. May you be blessed for your good judgment and for keeping me from bloodshed this very day and from avenging myself with my own hands. Otherwise, as surely as the Lord, the God of Israel, lives, if you had not come quickly to meet me, not one male belonging to Nabal would have been left alive by daybreak." Hang on, this is a different kind of man, isn't it? This is a man who acknowledges this woman's intelligence, her common sense, her godliness. He was God's man and he recognised the godly woman. So what have you learnt? What have we learnt? How are we to live for God in our dysfunctional families? The first thing is we live with dignity. And look, I learned that the hard way. I learned it the hard way. Be Ephesians 1 woman. If you're having trouble living with dignity, read Ephesians 1 and see if you can see the dignity that God gives us as believers. Be an Ephesians 1 woman. Live with dignity. Live without self-pity, not a victim of circumstances. Understand you are responsible for your own relationships. Know when to hold your tongue and when to speak up. Act with common sense for the good of others. Know God for yourself. That's the message of the story of Abigail.